a better way. You don't have to be another face in the crowd. Well, hi folks, this is Jack Spirko with the Survival Podcast. Welcome to an episode of Friday Flashbacks. After 15 years and hundreds of interview shows, we decided to run them as flashbacks every Friday. Beginning with the oldest of them and going forward, there's a tremendous library of wisdom in all the great interviews we've done over the years. So sit back and enjoy. Whether this is your first time or even your second time around with today's episode, I'm sure you will enjoy it and learn a lot from it. And remember, you can help support the Survival Podcast and the work we do just by becoming a member of the Survival Podcast Members Support Brigade. If you do that, you'll get access to over 70 awesome discount codes on products and services you likely already use. Things like seeds, cannabis products, food storage items, custom roasted coffee, and even cool stuff like ammo and moonshine stills and more. So support the show, get all your money back and more. Just go to thesurvivalpodcast.com and click on members to learn more and sign up. Now let's get into today's Friday Flashback. And today we are flashing back to March 22nd, 2011. This was, I think, the second or third interview that I did with no less than Paul Wheaton. And this one is on the elimination of irrigation. Just a little, you know, new content for the beginning here. I would just say that I think that eliminating irrigation is completely possible in some places. Not everywhere, but in some places. But the same strategies you use to eliminate it in some places, you can use to mitigate the need in others. So I think this is a timeless episode. A lot of Paul's wisdom in it, and let's go ahead and flash back now to March the 22nd, 2011. All right, folks, as I said during the introduction segment, we're fortunate to have the return of one of our most popular guests, Paul Wheaton, who is kind of a guru of all things permaculture, coming to us from the wilds of Montana today. And we're going to talk all about irrigation, or actually, as Paul would put it, the lack of the need for irrigation if you do things right and smart. Paul, welcome back to the Survival Podcast.
Thanks, Jack. And you're calling me a guru. You make me sound so cool.
Well, that's my job, man. I got to make you sound cool, you know. Well, who else is going to do it if I don't? Seriously, man, you really have been one of our top guests, and we've had you on kind of the general broad-spectrum shotgun approach. We had you come back on and talk about Wafati eco-buildings, and today we want to talk about irrigation. And well, I was talking to you about this before. What you actually said to me is you kind of usually start out these types of presentations by talking about the imaginary birth of irrigation. Could you maybe say a little bit for us on that?
Well, okay, so by imaginary, I mean this is what happens in my head. And so, you know, what I imagine is that 10,000 years ago, people started getting the idea of rather than wandering off into the woods and finding food to eat and bringing it back, they started to plant the seeds near their home. And then eventually these little plants would pop up and they would do fine for a couple of years. And then after a while, they wouldn't do so good. And it's because, of course, the soil's getting depleted as time passes. And so then the plant would get to a point where it would look sad. It would be like, you know, clearly thirsty. So then the person would think, I know just what I'm going to do. I'm going to take a bucket down to the creek and bring it back and give it water. So that's the birth of irrigation. Now, of course, once you start watering it, then there's all kinds of problems that come with it. And then permaculture is going to be more like, well, how did that plant get on without irrigation for so long, and now when that person's irrigating it, then it seems to become more and more dependent on the irrigation. So permaculture is all about how can we get so well aligned with nature, how can we grow our things so well aligned with nature that we don't have to do the irrigation stuff. So that's a big part of where I'm thinking about it. If nothing else, consider when you irrigate, there is often the expense of the materials used to transfer the water, whether it's a bucket or a hose or a bunch of irrigation pipe or an entire plumbing system. A lot of people go to a lot of trouble to introduce water in an area so that they can, you know, connect up their hoses and their pipes and whatnot to irrigate. Then there's oftentimes the expense of just getting the water there, whether it's coming out of a city tap or whether it's coming out of, you know, out of the ground. You're pumping it out of the ground through all the pipes to get it out there to irrigate it. And then, or another one that people are doing now is they're doing water capture systems. They're getting these barrels, and I hope I don't piss off a whole bunch of your listeners by saying this, but every time I hear somebody saying, oh, I went and got a barrel, isn't that awesome, isn't that permaculture, I kind of think, nuh-uh, it ain't. I kind of think of that as like, well, you just went and dropped, you know, anywhere from $50 to $500 to capture water from your roof, which in many states is illegal. You're not allowed to capture water.
Which, by the way, in defense of people doing it, I think that's asinine to tell me I can't capture the water off my roof if I want to. Really kind of strikes sideways of the libertarian in me. But I get what you're saying. I mean, I was talking to somebody about your approach to this recently. They said, but, you know, obviously if it never rained, the plant wouldn't grow, and all I'm doing is supplementing the rain. And I'm kind of interested in what, you know, it's the first time I ever thought about this from your angle and then from this person's angle. I said, well, when we water something with a hose or with a soaker hose or with anything, I'm creating this little pocket of moisture surrounded by all this dry earth, and you wonder why it takes so much. Well, all of that dry earth just kind of wicks it away. It's not anything close to what happens when it rains. I'm actually flushing nutrients out of one location into the other locations where I don't really need them to be right now.
And that's going to depend entirely on the kind of soil that you have, the kind of subsoil you have, the different layers of soil down below. I mean, it's because for a lot of places, you'll go and you'll water it, and it just rinses all the nutrients, all the organic matter, all the yumminess of the soil down to where your plant can't reach it, or even worse, into your drinking water, where you probably don't want it. It'll make your water taste funny.
And then in some places, the other thing it does is it leaves behind the one thing we don't want, which is salt. And, I mean, that's a huge problem they have in Australia right now. They water, 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 and they end up with salted earth. And I don't know if you've ever tried to grow a plant in a pile of salt, but it doesn't work really well.
Yeah. And I think that the salt stuff comes from a different way. But you know, for most folks in the U.S., which I assume is most of your audience anyway, I think that one of the most important things to think about when you're out there watering is you know, take a patch of raspberries and abuse the hell out of it. Hardly ever water it. And take another patch of raspberries and water it gobs and gobs. And now taste the raspberries. You'll find that the raspberries have been watered taste like water. There's like hardly any flavor to it. Whereas the raspberries that you've totally abused have fantastic flavor. They're like more flavorful than anything you can buy in the store, more flavorful than possibly anything you've ever tasted before. And this is true for nearly everything. And but it's like, you know, most people are like raising food because they like the better flavor of it. And they're doing just the right things to make it so that their food has basically no flavor.
I mean, and there's precedent for this. If you talk to somebody that makes great wines, they're not going to be the person that, you know, irrigates the hell out of their vineyard. If you want the complexity in a wine, they always say you have to allow the vines to struggle somewhat. So I guess that makes sense when we move in other foods. And I remember, like, as a kid growing up, we used to go pick wild blueberries. And I remember the first time somebody handed me some blueberries that came from a store. I'd never seen one before, and they were huge, like the size of a grape. And I thought, this is awesome. And then I ate it. I said, that's not a blueberry. That doesn't taste anything like a blueberry.
Right. Oh, yeah, absolutely. And I've got a video up on YouTube where I visit this guy in Bellingham, where he's got this soil that's 3 feet deep. And I start the video by tasting his blueberries, and he's got these amazing, awesome blueberries. And then he proceeds to say that this area he has not watered at all that year, and we're videoing in August. And I said, well, like, what, does it rain a lot here or something? He says, we haven't had any noticeable rain for over 2 months. And so he's already gone 2 months without any rain, and, you know, the blueberries are awesome. And then I proceed to video more of what he's growing in this area, and it's like we approach the squash plants, and the leaves on all these squash plants are all perfect. Whereas on this particular trip, I'd already visited a bunch of different farms and gardens, and the squash plants all looked miserable and pathetic. So, but usually those were being watered, and it's the watering that actually was causing the problems, in my opinion. Getting mildew on the leaves and things like that, and cracking into bugs. But anyway.
But you were telling me earlier that, I mean, part of the problem is that we have gotten one-dimensional with this. We look at, you know, irrigation, and we say, okay, I'm going to provide water for the plant. And we do that pretty much in one way. It doesn't matter if it's from a rain barrel or from a garden hose or from drip irrigation or whatever. We take water to the plant. We just put it there, and we go, okay, drink. But plants, as you say, in the wild, have many ways they get their water.
Oh, absolutely. I sat down, and it was like about a year and a half ago where somebody asked me a question during a presentation, and I sat there and I came up with seven ways off the top of my head, and then I thought, you know, this would be a good presentation on its own. So I whipped up a presentation, and as I sat there and thought about it, I think I came up with 14 ways, and I'm looking at this list now, and I think a little later in your show we're going to cover that whole list of all these different ways. But yeah, it's like tomato plants. I mean, they're the quintessential plant for everybody's garden. It's like the iconic plant. And so how did those tomato plants get by for thousands of years before we showed up? Don't they know that we're here to help them? And the other thing is they have the audacity to grow in a desert. They have the audacity to be from a desert. In fact, one of my favorite cherry tomato plants is Matt's Wild Cherry, which is a variety of cherry tomato that was recently discovered in Mexico. And it was not in an oasis or anything like that. It's out in this dry space.
But I guess, the other side of that is that tomato doesn't grow all by itself with nothing but tomatoes in a perfectly manicured space, full exposure to the sun at all times, growing in a cage, held up with twisty ties. That's not how that thing grows in the wild, is it?
Absolutely. Correct. And there's sure as hell nobody with a hose over there watering it out in the middle of the desert.
So how does it get by in the desert? Because, I mean, I'm going to tell you right now, even me, right, and I love you, and I'm a little bit skeptical because, like, I grew tomatoes in Pennsylvania as a kid, and we very rarely watered. We had great soil. We took good care of it. I had a lot of diversity going on. I was some level of permaculture. I didn't even know what the word meant at the time. I was just a kid, and it worked there. But pulling this off in Texas when it's 111 degrees seems a little bit more complex. So how does one relate to the other? How do we get there from here, so to speak?
Well, in that particular example, let's consider that, what was growing next to it, what was nearby. Was it on, was it near a rock? And was it near a bunch of rocks? And what were those rocks doing for it? Was it in a shady spot? Was it, how exposed was it? Was it in a spot where soil may have accumulated and got to be a little bit deeper? So it would be good to explore all of these things. But the other thing is that I think when it comes to tomato, one of the things that I think is really important is, did that tomato start from seed or did somebody go out there and transplant it? Because whenever you transplant any plant, it has transplant shock. And this is why I love to bring in a tomato, because the tomato is the one that will tolerate, is a plant that will tolerate transplant shock really well. It may be, for all the standard garden plants that we're aware of, it's the one that tolerates transplanting better than, I believe, any other of the standard garden plants. And yet it still has the transplant shock. So it'll be set back for a week or two, maybe three, once it's been transplanted. So and then its root system is going to be not as massive and as robust as it would have been. Now, this is a great question I ask a lot of my presentations, especially when I'm giving this presentation, is I'll ask the audience, okay, who here has had a volunteer tomato just show up like a weed somewhere out in their garden and they decided to like let it go? And then you go out and you transplant your tomatoes, usually after the volunteers show up, And so now your volunteer is about the same size as your transplant. And so now throughout the season, which plant does better? Now, up until recently, the only answer I ever heard is that the volunteers, not only did better, like as a bigger plant, than the transplant, but they also produced more fruit than the transplant. And then recently somebody said that the transplant, one of my presentations, somebody said that the transplant didn't do as well. And I want to, you know, go and grill that person some more and find out, okay, what'd you do? Why is that? But, here's another thing too. When you water a plant, like let's say you go out there and you decide you're going to water it every day or water it every other day or whatever it is you're going to do, then, what kind of root structure does it build for itself? Is it, you know, and to answer my own question.
I'll do that for you. It's very shallow.
Very shallow, very lame, wimpy. It's all close to the surface where the water is, and it's, you're making a very lazy plant. And then you stop watering, and it doesn't have a deep, rich root system, and then it goes all sad on you. Oh, help me, I'm thirsty. So, now you have to go out there and keep watering it, or else it'll really suffer. So, that's a big part of it. If you never water it, then it puts out these roots down and down and down and down and down, and it finds more and more stuff. Now, of course, if your soil is like a bunch of gravel, okay, yeah, you know, no, that a tomato is not going to make it there. I mean, this is another big part of permaculture's edge. You're going to have, like, if you've got like 80 acres, you've got like 1,000 different kinds of edge going on. And if you scatter the whole place with tomato seeds, there's maybe 1% of your whole property that's going to perhaps be able to sustain tomatoes.
But guess what? That's where you grow your frickin' tomatoes, right? You grow them where the environment is right for them. So instead of trying to force the tomatoes into the 4-foot by 8-foot rectangle that happens to be where I want it, I find the place that's conducive to the tomatoes' growth.
Well, either you find the place that's conducive, or you provide the place that's
conducive. I create it. So it's up to me. If I want it there, I got to create the environment.
So the thing that, you know, the way that you found out that I exist on this planet is that you found my Hugel culture videos on YouTube.
That's correct. Exposure to you.
So then when I try to talk to people about this, because, of course, usually the first reaction is I say I can grow tomatoes all year, all summer long, without any irrigation. And their first response is no, you can't. You're a lying bastard. I hate you. Go away. And so then Hugel culture is like the simplest thing that you can present to somebody so that they'll then change their mind. Okay, I guess you're not so crazy. And okay, I can see how that can work. And so that's like one tool. And you know what? It is so good. Hugel culture is such an amazing thing that if you want to take the time and expense and whatever else to do it, you could just have that be your magic bullet. Just do that and everything else falls into place. Everything else will be fine. You just have to do the one thing and you'll be great. But coming back to what you said earlier, there's like really about 14 things that I can think of. There's probably 50 things that nature does, many of which I'm not yet aware of, but there's 14 that I can think of. And Hugel culture would be right up. I mean, in nature, we call them nurse trees. You know, so a tree falls over and dies and rots, and then stuff grows next to it, and then that big, huge, rotting log is holding water from all winter, and it's also collected nutrients, and so then plants continue to get water and nutrients from it throughout the summer, even though it hasn't been raining lately.
Absolutely, and as a guy that grew up hunting and fishing in the woods of Pennsylvania all the time, I can tell you that I came across that all the frickin' time. And then when you hear about something like Hugel culture, you almost look at it and go, well, stupid, why didn't you think of that? Because it just seems like, duh, there it is right in front of you. And I guess, you know, we go back to Lawton and Mollison telling us the forest is the teacher, but I guess we have to actually pay attention and learn.
Well, I think almost everything in permaculture has a great big duh, you know, on it. it's amazing how the videos, especially the videos that I put out, how I'll encounter people and they will say that things are absolutely this one way and there is no possibility for the other way. And then they watch the video, which shows them another way. And then they're like, well, duh, it's always been that way. There's nothing special about this video. And then I just kind of snicker to myself and think, yeah, there's nothing special about this video except that a moment ago you were saying that there is no other way. You know, and so it's kind of like I feel like we're moving forward in a big way by making these little stupid videos that just expose these points that are obvious to people, but that they kind of seem to have forgotten.
Oh, I completely agree, because I think when a person looks at that, right, then the first thing they say, you know, is and they kind of poo-poo it because they're uncomfortable. And we just did a lot of stuff on survival about how when you break the comfort bubble, people try to, like, minimize it. But that kind of plants a seed, and people start to question other things and go, well, if there's more than one way to do this, right, then maybe there's more than one way to do everything. And I guess I'm like the complete opposite of the average person, because everything I look at, I'm like, how can I improve it? How can I make it better? How can I do it different? Even if I change it and it breaks it, then, okay, well, that was a bad idea. Now let's try something else. And I think that your videos are doing that for a lot of people. They're making them finally say, hey, maybe there's something more to this than 4-foot by 8-foot beds, growing plants in a straight line, buying my plants from a nursery, transplanting them at the 2 weeks after the last frost date, watering them every day, and waiting for summer to eat this stuff.
Right. I think you know, we're making progress in this space. I think my impression is, when I look at the forums at permies.com, then I see tons and tons of people building hugel culture beds now, and they're sharing pictures and they're sharing their results. And in fact, I went on this great big drive. I took 4 days of driving, and I ended up in Northern California, where there's a small plot of land where people are doing a lot of the stuff that they've learned from Permies. And from my articles and things like that. So basically, they've been doing all this stuff that we've been talking about, and I got plenty of video to be uploading from their success stories and from the things that are working out well for them. And I hope to be able to go back there again in a year and get even more. So it's just a matter of getting the word out, really.
So, hey, we've kept people waiting long enough. Let's give them, what are these 14 ways that you have that plants get water in nature?
Okay, so normally when I'm giving the presentation, I talk about the evidence of the big names in permaculture who have proven this to be true. So forgive me as I put off the 14 things for just a moment.
Fair enough.
And I say, okay, let's talk about, first of all, Sepp Holter, the mighty, the glorious, the amazing Sepp Holter. He did a project in Spain where it's like desert. It's like 3 inches of rain a year. And there's two important things he did there. One is that he brought back lakes. So here it is, sand and a few dying oak trees in this area. And he comes to the area and he says, there used to be lakes here. And people are saying, no. So he did his thing, and lakes returned to the area. So the other thing is that there was these experimental garden beds. And you got to keep in mind that when he's doing this, there's like this 20,000 acres that's owned by some princess of something or another, and she brought in like 20 different experts and gave each expert a plot of land, and all these experts that are not Sepp Holter are apparently spending their time going to Sepp's plot and bitching about how he's a dumb fuck and they're just like doing everything all wrong, and so then they come and they complain, and so and it's like, hey, don't you have your own piece of land? Piss off. So he ended up doing this garden bed experiment, and he did them both as hugel culture, only the other people, the other 19 guys, were all saying, it'll never work, you have to irrigate it. So then he did two, and they irrigated one and didn't irrigate the other one. They did, you know, so the first year they had equal crops off of both hugel cultures. And then on the second year, they decided to stop the irrigation on the other one because, you know, why irrigate if you have equal crops? So they stopped the irrigation, and then the second one all died. Everything died because, of course, you know, it had the shallow, wimpy roots. It couldn't cope. So anyway, those are two stories. And then there's Sepp Holter in Austria, where he has 110 acres or so, and he doesn't irrigate anything. And so he gets about 30 inches, I think 28 inches of rain per year there, but it's of course all during the winter, and spring and fall when you know things aren't growing so much, and then he'll have like a summer of 3 months where it doesn't rain at all. So even though there's a lot of annual rainfall, it's not coming when he needs it.
But he's got the ground saturated by then.
Yeah, he's got a great big sponge. And there's a lot more to tell about that story, but the key is that there's lots of space on this mountainside where there's, it's far from any water and it's totally dry and he's raising tons of stuff. Next up is Jeff Lawton in Jordan. And so if you go to YouTube, look up, Greening the Desert and make sure that you also find part two. The story is just spectacular. He goes to Jordan and it's like, I mean, you know, you look around, it's desert, rocks and sand, and it's like once in a while you could see some kind of piece of scrub growing somewhere. And so then he does the permaculture thing, and then you've got this video of 7 years later. And so then apparently after he did his permaculture thing on that piece of property, then 2 years later the people that owned that property sold it. And then whoever bought it, they didn't know what was going on, but it was green, so they just turned the goats loose on it, and then those people sold it. So 7 years later, it's been through the hands of a bunch of different people who have no idea what's going on. They just have this oasis out of nowhere for no, they can't imagine what the reason is. So in this video 7 years later, there's these trees that are like 30 feet tall and brush, and it's all green and lush all over the place, whereas, you know, outside the property, it's still this big desert of nothing.
Yeah, because I watched that, and basically the people that own it now kind of screwed a lot of it up. They're running their drip irrigation the wrong direction and all, and they're letting the goats go nuts on it. But a lot of it, even with the abuse, has survived, and the place looks totally different. It's like this pot of green surrounded by desert, and the way he described it is like the goats are like maggots eating, you know, the flesh off the land everywhere else.
Right. Oh, yeah. So, I mean, imagine what would happen if it was still... But the thing is, it looks crazy lush now, despite the abuse. And it's just shows you how powerful permaculture can be. And again, you know, they did have some forms of irrigation there, but then the general recipe for permaculture in a desert area like that is that you're going to baby it for 5 years, and then you're going to walk away, and it's going to do great by itself. The next story has to do with Willie Smits in Borneo, and there's a TED talk about him. It's just like, you know, you wanna give this guy a crown, a big pedestal, give him some Nobel prizes. I mean, you know, as you watch this video, it's like they have to be like 18 minutes or something like that. It's just stunning what he can convey in 18 minutes. But basically, it sounds like my understanding from that and other things I've read around this is that in Borneo around 1900, we went in there and like, ooh, look, trees, let's cut them all down. And then the whole area kind of turned into a desert, whereas it used to be a jungle. And so now it's a desert, and the water's all nasty, and everybody's like miserable and sad and everything, and whatever it was that they had planned apparently didn't work out. So the whole area is just devastated. And so then he comes in and he starts doing the permaculture thing, and they're getting trees to grow and lushness is coming back, and it's like in 3 years they've got trees that are like 20 feet tall, 25 feet tall, and they've got water, everything's going great. They've measured stuff. They're measuring all kinds of stuff all over this property. And because it's a big part of it, it's a research project. And rainfall on the third year is up 20% for the area. And they go on about how they've effectively proved it's because they planted the trees there, and because of this big tree growth there.
Yeah, I'll tell you, if you don't think trees cause rain, you don't understand rain. I completely agree with that. I haven't seen everything else you're talking about. I've seen. I haven't seen this, so I'll have to look this up and provide a link in the show notes. Never heard of this guy. It sounds amazing what this guy's doing.
It's just stunning. 18 minutes just changes your life. And then I've got two more. One's not on my slides here. I got to maybe update it. But just real quick, there's a 30-minute animated thing that is fiction based on a true story called The Man Who Planted Trees, a beautiful story. Basically, great big desert area in, I believe, Spain. And then there's this guy who has just taken it upon himself. He calls it doing God's work. And he plants 100 tree seeds every day for his life. And turns this area that's probably got to be 100 square miles into lushness from desert. It's a beautiful thing to watch. It's just really beautiful. And then finally, Bill Mollison himself in Australia. And this is a great story because there's this little town in Australia where they hate Bill Mollison's guts. They can't say his name without spitting. What happened was is that there was this time apparently like 20, 25 years ago where the town was drying up. It was just a big desert area and people were leaving and there's hardly anybody left in the town. And somehow they worked a deal with Bill Mollison to come and green the place. So he came and he greened it, and now it's like this lush, jungly oasis in the middle of the desert, and they hate his guts for it because one of the plants that he planted was a thornless honey locust. And some of the offspring of the, because it's a genetic fluke, a mutation that you have a honey locust that doesn't have thorns.
So nature found its way back to thorns?
Oh yes, absolutely. the seeds that came off of that plant, had thorns, or at least most of them did. And so now, and I don't know if you know about a honey locust plant, but they have thorns that are like 3 inches long.
Oh, I'm very familiar with honey locusts. Yeah, they're interesting plants. Yeah.
Oh yeah. The farmers used to use those thorns as nails, and farmers know you never drive the tractor anywhere near the honey locust tree if you want to keep your tires intact. So there's my stories of the big players, doing it.
It makes me think of another thing I remember seeing with Mollison in that Global Gardener series he did back in the 80s. And it was the drylands one, and he was in the United States in the desert southwest, where during the Great Depression with the Civilian Conservation Corps, Roosevelt sent these guys out in the desert to put these swales in. Now, they didn't do it to grow stuff. They did it because it was basically washing the desert sands across the road and screwing up the road. And where they were irrigating to grow cotton for the war effort, it was, washing out the cotton beds when it rained, three times a year. So all they did was put these swales in to stop the water. Well, he's standing in the middle of the swale. It was built in like 1934, right? Or 36 or whatever. No one's even been near it for almost 100 years now, say 80 years. And he digs down, and in the middle of the desert where everything's gravel and sand, there's soil. Now, it's not rich loam like, Iowa farmland, but it's real soil, and there's trees and bushes and for miles along the swale line, and no one ever did anything. Nobody even planted anything there. They just put the swales in and walked away. And if you can grow anything there, you should be able to grow something anywhere.
Absolutely. Absolutely. What a great demonstration. And I think, was it in that same video where they had something that was like a coltsfoot roller and putting little indentations in the land? And
yeah, all the guy did was drive and make pockmarks in the desert. It looked very much like a piece of equipment we used in Honduras when I was there building roads, except that it had this very specific design so that the marks it made in the ground were like these little funnels. And just the wind would blow, pack rat crap and all kinds of stuff, and seeds would catch in the bottom. They watered nothing, and you just looked at a place that 2 years ago we had run over, and it was green. And they're in the middle of, I think that was New Mexico.
It's like 10 times more lush than the place right next to it.
Absolutely.
That didn't have the thing driving on it.
But that was all brilliant. He did. He made little pock marks I couldn't believe that when I looked at that and I went, that is flipping insane. The guy drives a car basically with some special pockmark making, and they weren't big holes. They were about, the size and diameter of the round of the top of a coffee cup.
Yeah.
You could literally, if you wanted to, you probably could have took a stick. Right, a stick, and if you were bored and had nothing to do for a couple of years, you could have went out there and made holes with sticks and done the same thing. Unbelievable. So now are we going to get to the 14 ways plants get...
Now we have the list. I'm going to count 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, 12, 13, 14, 15. My list is currently at 16.
So we get two-part bonus. Let's go.
All right. First one's hugel culture. We've covered that in one of your previous podcasts. It's nothing more than big chunks of wood covered in soil. and then the wood rots, and then that wood acts as a massive sponge for water and nutrients. And if you build these things 6 feet tall, it will contain enough water to get you through the summer. So, you can do all of it in that one hit. The next thing is polyculture. So, if you have your carrot growing next to an oak tree, and the oak tree has a deep taproot, then the oak tree is hopefully being able to find all the water that it needs way down deep. And then as it transpires water, it's basically like a big water pump. And then it also does a nutrient exchange with the mycelium in the soil, including exchange with the carrot. So it takes in carroty goodness while the carrot takes in oaky goodness, and then the carrot's getting water. I don't think they can get enough water to do everything that it needs to do that way. Maybe in some instances it can, but the thing is that's one thing that's a big help.
It gets some, right?
So polyculture.
It mitigates some level of need, in this case through transpiration, mitigates some of the need for water.
Well, and it's not through, in fact, transpiration is another way of doing it. Transpiration, and it's going to put like a whole bunch of water just into the air, which will then be returned to the plant through dew. But just through the polyculture of the root to root exchange through the mycelium, then you're going to get, because basically, like when the, because the oak tree is going to exude oak tree goodness, and the carrot plant is going to exude carroty goodness. And there can be some direct exchange, but it's like 10 times more exchange if you've got a really good mycelium in the soil. And so then, which happens a lot when your soils mature without being tilled. And so now that there's like a really awesome exchange, and then the medium that's being used to get your oak tree goodness and your carroty goodness, the medium that carries that is water. And so now, as the oak tree, the oak tree's got lots of water, so it exudes lots of water through its roots, through its leaves, through everything, but it's mostly through the roots is what I'm talking about.
Gotcha. Let me stop you right there, because I have an I told you so moment. See, folks, this is why I've been telling you for 2 years, stop turning the soil over, stop plowing the soil, stop tilling the soil. There's life down there, and you're screwing it up. Because once it figures out its little happy place, and it's all happy, and it's growing at its stratified pH level, and it's where it belongs, you come along with a rototiller, whoa, 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 and you mess everything up. That's not how the forest works. Go on. It was just like the perfect moment for that.
So on that note, I've got two things. One is that I recently uploaded a video just a few days ago, Living Mulch, about living mulches, but it's also about till versus no-till versus low-till. And basically it's Helen Attow, goddess of the soil. So I talked in one of your previous podcasts about the Wheaton Ecoscale and how there's, like, when you get to level 10, there's only one guy, and that's Sepulcher. And so at level 9, there are 10 people, and one of those 10 people is Helen Attow. And it sounds like this evening I'll be interviewing her for a podcast, or one of my podcasts later. And she still does some till once in a while. And I believe that there are times when till is good. And
agreed. But it's not every 15 minutes.
Oh right. No, now my philosophies are different from Helen's, and I kind of think that that's what our podcast is going to be about. Is going to be about, like, okay, you know, let's compare our philosophies and compare and contrast, because we both have strong opinions on this. And she's got a very deep science background in this. Soil science is her thing. At the same time, I believe that the one time that you might actually work your soil is if there's no organic matter in there. I mean, the soil is like without life. It's not soil. It's dirt.
It's dead. It's inert freaking sponge matter, which is where most of our farms are at right now.
And so in which case it's like, okay, now we can till the soil because it's not soil. We're going to till the dirt. You know, but tilling soil is a bad idea, because then, yeah, you break up all the soil structure and you lose all of the tilth. You basically, one way to make a pond is to till it. You know, and so you go in there, you got your pond, you've dug out your pond bowl. Now go in there and till it. And that'll make it so that it'll seal.
You know, that's so important that you said that, because I don't think people get that. What they're doing with the rototiller is they're making a giant pot. Because they are, right? Because they get that rototiller and they drive it through there, and it makes all that nice, loamy-looking, chopped-up dirt. But down where you can't see, the bottom of those tillers, all they've done is flat smashed and compacted the earth about 8 inches down. So you got this great, you stick your hand there, look how nice that is. Stick your hand 8 inches down, you're going to feel what feels like clay stone. I mean, that's exactly what happens when you till, plow, what have you.
Well, when we're building a hugelkultur bed, we are making masses of organic matter. I mean, basically where that log is, you have 100% organic matter in your soil at that point. Now, for the whole bed, you've got something like 80% organic matter for the whole hugelkultur bed that's 6 feet tall. And now you look at, like, really lame soil, it has less than 1% organic matter. And then when you look at soil that's really good, for your standard garden soil, is typically 10% organic matter. And now, here's the important point. Every time you till, you lose 30% of your organic matter to the atmosphere. And that's because as organic matter breaks down, it's like perpetually composting. It gets to such a tiny little molecular bit that it's like either on the edge of being a gas, or it's like on, it is a gas, or it's something that can be carried away by a gas.
Correct. And I think the other thing there is, like, people don't understand, like, they do this one time and they get great results the first time because you've done that. And a lot of that you don't lose initially, you kind of, like, supercharge. Like, if you feel depressed because you're B12 deficient and I come give you a B12 shot, well, you're happy Paul for a while. But as soon as that B12 runs out, you're done. So we need to fix your diet or why you're not absorbing B12, not just keep giving you shots, because the shot that we get by tilling that soil, we only get to do that so many times, and then it's gone.
Right. So there is a big nutrient release. I mean, a lot of the nutrients are kind of locked up and stuff like that. And it's a very sophisticated space in the soil. And yes, when you go and you break a bunch of that stuff, now you've made a bunch of it released into the atmosphere, and you've made a bunch of it that's more available in the soil. So it was in a state of decomposition that was like of a certain size, and then you broke it open, and then some of it went into the atmosphere, but now more of it's available to plants. But at the same time, if no plants are there to take it up, which is the case when you just tilled, then even more of it's going to get released in the atmosphere until the plant can finally grow enough to get to it. Anyway, this topic alone could probably fill 5 or 6 books, and that's just with the stuff that is currently known. I imagine that what is not known in this space is probably about 100 times bigger than that.
I agree, but let's keep going on your list here, because we got to get them all out.
next is trees. Having more trees. So the idea is, like, okay, the list is stuff that's going to make it so that we can replace irrigation with permaculture. Next up is trees, and trees are going to provide a bunch of different stuff. And so in a way, my list kind of cheats, because I'm going to talk about some, like, you know, the tap-rooted stuff. We're going to talk about shade. We're going to talk about a bunch of different things. But basically, trees themselves. And it's like, you know what? We've got the things that we know about, such as shade. So if we have a little bit of shade, it makes things a little bit cooler, which helps to enhance getting more morning dew. And it helps us to get, less stuff getting dried out and taken away.
We got condensation drip. I mean, in a dry environment, that might be a third of the annual perspiration, just the condensation drip.
Trees transpire and put more moisture into the air. Trees do tons and tons and tons of stuff. But basically, it's like a tree, just having trees in your garden, trees in your pasture, trees in your whatever it is that you're doing. Trees are a big magic ingredient that do so many things. In fact, Masanobu Fukuoka, it's amazing how much stuff he did that was similar to Sepp Holzer. And one of the things that he did is he went out and he started doing hugelkultur, and then he came back and said, after a while, I was like, this is a lot of work So he changed the way he did it, and he would plant catalpas, you know, a leguminous tree, and then when they got to a certain size, he'd kill them. And it's like, there you go. The tree made the hugel culture. It put this massive root system down in the ground.
Hold on. So basically he would just, what, level chop the catalpa off and leave the trunk in the ground and grow around it?
Yeah.
Awesome.
The root is underground, right?
So yeah.
It's down there. It's made of
the bed.
Underground.
Yeah, and a catalpa, they grow about 47 feet a second. I mean, they're... I have a neighbor that didn't believe me. He had one growing between the fence and his house, and it's in suburbia. So there's 10 feet there at the most. And it was up behind this little shed he just put in, and he said, I wonder what kind of tree that is. I said, it's a catalpa tree, dude. It's going to be about 25 feet tall in about 2 years, and if you don't want it there, you better cut it down now. Because it was really a bad place for a tree like that to be. So he doesn't believe me, and so after a year, he's like, well, they always grow faster first year. All right, dude. So now he's got this huge bean-dropping catalpa, and it's growing into his shed and moving it literally. And he's gonna have to bring in a guy that knows what they're doing to get that thing out of there. But yeah, so there's another duh. Of course, that would make sense.
Soon his house is gonna be a treehouse.
Exactly. No, seriously, it's really wedged in between the shed and the house, and it's just it's now actually in contact with the shed. And I told him whether he believes this or not, if you put a stake at the end of where your shed is and you measure it by the end of the summer, it is going to move your shed over. And he doesn't believe that either, so some people learn the hard way.
You should give him that book, Jack and the Beanstalk.
Maybe it wasn't really a beanstalk. Maybe it was a catalpa.
I mean, it's got bean pods on it, you know.
You're right. Okay, so let's keep going with your list.
Okay, mulch. Everybody knows about mulch. You know, I mean, if you go out there and you put, my favorite mulch is going to be hay. I think Ruth Stout is, it was spot on. In one of your previous podcasts, we talked about how amazing Mel Bartholomew's square foot gardening book is. And I've got to say that, that's got some really great information in it. The next one I think would be Ruth Stout stuff, but I think she wrote that in 1920 or something, and I'm amazed that here we are in the year 2011, and I'm amazed that it's not 90% of all people who have a garden don't do it the Ruth Stout way, which in a way is really awesome because then it makes it easier for me to get my hands on hay.
Yeah, I was just gonna say, for some of us, it's the I can't just run down the road here and pick up a few hay bales. It's not real accessible where I'm at. We don't grow a lot of it here.
Oh, really? I didn't know that.
Not in Dallas. I mean, it's just not, and it's not something that I routinely have available to me. Now, when I was growing up in PA, we always used hay because it was, you could, kick a car and there was a hay bale underneath it. I mean, it was everywhere. So,
yeah.
You make do, I guess, with what you have locally available. At least you try to.
Yeah. So mulch, the key is mulch. And in the permaculture world, we do a lot of chop and drop, which is where, you go along and it's like, oh, look at all this stuff I don't want in my garden. Choppity, choppity, chop, and then just leave it there. And now you've got mulch.
Correct. And that's why people say, look at all those weeds in your garden. Why don't you pull them out? I'm waiting for them to get bigger. So then when I pull them out, they'll have more organic matter. I mean, and if you have good beds, it's like, well, that's going to be hard to get out of there. And you just grab it with two fingers and it just extracts beautifully.
Right. Oh, yeah. Isn't that awesome?
It is awesome.
There's the root. Boy, that dandelion, it had a root 3 feet long.
I was just going to say that the dandelions are my favorite because you can make a wine from dandelion root that tastes like a dry sherry. And I can either struggle with getting the dandelions out of the lower portion of my lawn where it's all compacted down there, or I can let a couple of them grow in my garden bed until they're nice and big and start to produce those little yellow flowers. And then I just walk over and I just lift them up out of there, and I've got, 10 or so big giant roots to make that dry sherry type of wine with. And it's a crop, and I didn't have to do anything except that those little fuzzy things land there and start them out. Now, my neighbors are not real happy about my lawn, but I like my dandelions. I make dandelion root wine. I make dandelion blossom wine. And come to think of it, I've never watered a dandelion in my life.
Yeah, no, you don't have to. They've got that awesome taproot. And I got a video up on YouTube where it's of Michael Pilarski, and he's got, okay, look at these dandelions that grew in my garden. I never planted them. They just showed up. And last year, about this time of year, I went and pulled a bunch up, and I sold them for $900. It's a cash crop.
Yeah, I saw that video. That was an awesome video. $900 worth of dandelions. That was the name of the video.
Yeah. And so it's like he says he's going to get at least that much this year. So it's like, wow, awesome. I mean, plus the other thing is a dandelion, it's an awesome polyculture crop. You leave the dandelions in because you don't have to water them, and then they share water with other stuff, and they're a nutrient accumulator. They're a calcium accumulator. Dandelions, it's like if you had a horrible dandelion infestation under your fruit tree, that's like 20 times better than having grass under your fruit tree.
Well, not only that, but then you think about this, Paul. People go out and they do start to catch on to this, you know, open up the earth thing and a little bit of permaculture principles and cover crops. They have a great big dandelion infestation they want to get rid of, and then they go in and they plant daikon radish.
Daikon radish is awesome.
They are awesome, but, you know, are we going to try to eliminate the dandelion that's basically doing the same thing?
Oh, right, yeah.
You see what I'm saying? So it's like, don't you understand that, like, add the daikon, but leave the dandelions because they're doing the same thing. It's that deep, that's how, you know, the daikon, of course, they die, and then that whole root system dies, and it's a beautiful fast carbon pathway. But dandelions are pretty much doing the same thing on a smaller scale, and they don't require seeding. They just do what they do.
Yeah, and you know, I think that's a big part of permaculture. In fact, I get tons of people who come to me and they say, because I get invited to lots of farms to take video and whatever, and I go to farms and gardens all over the place all the time. And then, oh, you should go out to this place. They've got aquaponics system set up. Go check that out. And then I say, I'm not really interested in aquaponics because I don't think of it as permaculture. I mean, it's a lot of work to get that. I mean, you're setting up a big artificial environment. You got to feed the fish. You got to do all this stuff. What I think is permaculture is aquaculture, where you set up a big pond and then you set up systems that are like your trout habitat and your trout food habitat. And then you walk away and you come back in 2 years and get your trout. As opposed to an aquaponics where it's like you're there, you know, a couple of times a day making sure everything's okay and feeding them and stuff like that. So with the dandelions, it's kind of like that. People are going out there and they're doing all this work. And it's like this constant, they're married to their garden. And I think that when you do permaculture the right way, then really once you got the system really working well, all you do is you show up and harvest. You don't even plant seeds. And I agree with that. Mission, which I think a lot of people, it's a little much for them to get their head wrapped around. So it's better if we talk about like the little steps that'll get you like, you know, 20% of the way there. And then once you're 20% of the way there, then we can talk about getting you 40% of the way there. And once you're 40% of the way there, we can talk about, you know, and then eventually maybe people will get to the point where they can understand, oh, yeah, I get it. All you do is harvest.
Correct. And there might be little things you do along the way. Like, I grow tons of basil. I haven't started a basil plant or a basil seed forever. But, you know, when they're all in seed, I just grab a big handful right off the thing and throw it on the ground, and that kind of helps the process along. And that kind of helps me get the basil where I want the basil. But if I did nothing, there's going to be basil this year. And it's going to be everywhere. And I don't have to, and this is a suburban area where I've actually held back because I don't even want to put so much effort into this place. We're leaving next month. We're finally out of here. I've got right now, I went out in the garden. I'm not even planting this year because I want whoever moves in to kind of like have a blank slate. I don't like that, and now it's a pain in the ass or whatever. But I've got eggplant. I've got tomatillo. I've got basil. All this stuff's just coming up. The gardens are planting themselves this year.
Yeah, awesome.
It's unbelievable. I got like 6 inches of mulch down to keep everything down and just like sterile looking for when people come to the house. And they're like, screw that. I'm coming through the mulch. Here I am. I'm growing. Take it whether you like it or not. And that's so awesome. But I've only been doing this here for 4 years, and we've gotten to that already. It is possible.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. And it's so easy. All right, moving through the list. We've covered mulch, right? Chop and drop. Next on the list is raise humidity for more morning dew. So one great big way that people, sometimes you go to a place and it's the first thing in the morning and there's really no morning dew. And then you go to a place that's like 2 miles away, and it's like as you're walking along, your feet and your shoes and your pants are just soaked within a minute because there's just so much morning dew. And so, you know, part of it is let's focus on getting more morning dew. And a lot of it is like bring in water features. Have a little pond. Maybe there's a creek. Maybe there's, you know, whatever. But trees bring in more morning dew. Shady spots is more morning dew. There's lots of things to have more morning dew. So, another one is a system, it's Keyline, and this is based upon the book by P.A. Yeomans. This is something that's more for a larger scale kind of, property. And you know what? First of all, I'm gonna try and give a quick explanation of what Keyline is. Second of all, I've got a lot of people telling me that it's like, my explanation sucks. And that the system's far more robust, but that I've also had some people tell me that no, my explanation is good. But it's a full book. I mean, there's a lot to it. And so, finally, the thing is about it is that I don't really care for it that much. It seems to me like it's a lot of work. You need to do it every year. And while it is effective, I don't think the return on investment is that good, although, boy, there are a lot of people that are in the permaculture world exceptionally passionate about it. I just think there's better ways. And so basically it goes like this. You've got your land, and it's kind of hilly. Let's say you've got 1,000 acres, and it's kind of hilly. And so usually when the water falls, it takes the shortest path downhill. And so then you have gullies, and in the gullies, that's where all the water ends up, is going into the gullies. And so then the stuff that's more like the rounded part of your hills, that ends up being, drier. So then the whole idea with a keyline system is that you're going to go out there with a special keyline plow, which is basically a straight shank with a knob at the bottom. And usually what you'll do is that you'll dig it down about 18 inches, and you'll kind of map out what the contour lines are on a hillside, and then you'll make it so that the downhill path for your plow goes slowly below the contour lines, and will take the water out to the ends of the mounded hills. Does that make sense?
It makes sense. So it's basically a form of contour plowing.
Right. So you're going slightly below contour.
Got you.
In order to be able to get the water, instead of running to the gullies,
mm-hmm.
get the water to flow out to the hillside. And then the hillside, whenever you have a slight rain, rather than all that rain going to the gully, it ends up out more towards the hillside. You end up retaining water out on your land longer.
Got you. So it's like micro swaling in a way.
I don't want to say that. The swales are level.
Yeah, okay.
These are not level.
These are not level.
These are going slightly downhill away from the gullies.
So, okay, I'm seeing it backwards then. So it's not that the plow is going away from the ground and it's forcing the water out underneath. It actually is allowing spillover. This might be one we need a picture of to understand.
Yeah, there's more to it. I mean, there's a lot to it. I mean, there's a lot of fascinating stuff about it, and it is a rich system. It's an amazing system. The book was written in the 50s, I believe, by P.A. Yeomans, and I've read the book, and some people tell me that I did not retain what was offered in the book, but I don't know. I keep getting this varied feedback. Some people are saying, no, you're explaining it right, and so... But, I mean, there is a lot more to it, but I'm trying to make a quick explanation of it. This is like the one piece that I think people can understand the best, is the idea that you're going to try and get the water to, I mean, basically you're trying to get the water to stay on the land longer in a hilled environment.
Gotcha. That makes sense.
That's what we're trying to do. And it does, and my impression is that it buys you like 15%. You know, and which could make a big difference between stuff being green and brown. And if you look at a chunk of property that's had this done to it next to a similar chunk of property that has not had this done to it, like right next door, then you'll see greener, lusher stuff on the keyline stuff, and while it's getting kind of brown and wimpy over at the neighbors. So it does work. It's just that it doesn't buy you near as much as a lot of this other stuff does. And it requires, you know, doing it every year.
Gotcha. And which to me, that's not permaculture. That's maybe a permaculturist result, I guess is the way to put it, because if I have to constantly supply inputs, I don't have sustainability. As soon as I'm gone, the system stops working. Where if I'm really doing it sustainably, I should be able to go away and come back 5 years later, and maybe a whole lot of stuff fell and rotted and didn't get harvested, but other than that, the system should still be functioning.
Right. The system should get better and better every year without any inputs. Now, you know, granted, it'll get even better still if you come in there and you do a couple of things here and there. But it should be able to get better without you being there. And it seems to me like this is something that's a short-term gain. I think it's good to know it and to understand it and have it in your tool belt. But I imagine that there could be scenarios where it would be of great value, but for the most part, I think I'm going to go more towards terraces and swales and hugelkultur and things of that nature in general. Which leads me to the next item, terraces. This is the next item on the list. And so this is one that Sepulcher does a lot of, and of course we've all seen the pictures of terraces being done in like Asia, where, you know, here's this big, steep, crazy steep mountainside, and there's all these terraces where they're raising rice, you know, on these terraces. It's just amazing.
You know, Paul, I want to stop you there because I just thought of something I never thought of before with this, and that is we're teaching, you know, obviously we're teaching children the wrong things in school in a lot of ways, but on this one, I remember learning about down in the Andes people using terraces to grow food. And what we were told as kids was that they did this because the ground wasn't flat. No mention whatsoever about the advantages of irrigation. It was just basically, it's steep, you can't grow on it, so you flatten it out. And the entire reason it works is because of the water retention.
Right. So the thing we're doing is we're retaining water. Sep goes one step further, in that he does not make his terraces perfectly level. So he introduces terraces, but they always have a little bit of an up and down slopey thing kind of going on. And
so is he sloping them a little bit out so that they allow flow better, or is he sloping them back so they're almost doing a swale function?
That's an awesome question. That is an awesome question. So the thing is, it depends. I'm glad we had this chat.
Okay.
It depends on the soil type. I mean, if it's a clay soil and you make the slope go into the hillside, then you're going to make all that clay turn into jello, mm-hmm. and then it's going to move off of your property and visit the neighbors.
Correct. And I'm also making a big giant, basically a little lake. I'm making a pond there.
Well, kind of, yeah. And it's going to go, I mean, the thing is when it goes to visit your neighbors in the middle of the night, they might be upset about that.
Correct.
If they survive it.
Correct. Because I'm creating a landslide waiting to happen. But I guess now, you know, I look at if I look at my
sandy soil.
Yeah, I go to Arkansas. I've got rock. I've got silica. I've got sand. I would actually, and I'm getting ready to do this. This is why I'm asking. I've got a machine guy that's going to come in and help me do it. I'm going to want to put a little bit of a slightly canted back because I don't have that clay. I have a problem with soil retention.
Okay. No, yeah, right. So then you want to try and keep any soil from going. Yeah, you want to capture it. So if it's thinking about going downhill, you're going to be standing up and saying nuh-uh, and you're going to keep it on your land. But now I want to add a third dimension in here because now we're just talking about relative to uphill, downhill. Now I'm going to talk about relative side to side. And so you might be thinking of making it perfectly level side to side. And I'm going to say Sepulcher doesn't do that.
Well, good, because I can't do it. It's the environment just really precludes it.
Oh, okay. But do you know why you might? Because he'll make it so that it has either a gentle downward. I mean, it'll go up and down, or maybe just, you know, just down. Or do you, and can you tell me why he does that?
I really don't know. I mean, because I've always thought along, you know, the way when you do a swale, you do a dead level swale with a level sill for overflow. So why would you do that?
Okay, so yeah, a swale is going to be dead level. Yes, you're correct. And I don't think SEP does any swales that I can think of. I can't remember any swales. But the terraces are going to be kind of like a little wavy. They're going to go, you know, and they'll go up and down and up and down. So now, because he's doing that, you'll have some spots that are going to be kind of rounded at the top or kind of up high. That's going to be a little drier. And then you're going to have stuff that's going to be a little concave.
Let me cheat and jump ahead. It's all about microclimates. I'm creating microclimates here.
Microclimates, that's a good word. I was going to use the word edge.
Okay.
So in permaculture, we do a lot of stuff where we think, you know, there's all kinds of edges. We want to make, like, so in this case, we're going to make a water edge and also a soil edge where it comes down to a lower spot. You're going to accumulate more soil there than you did at the higher spot of the terrace.
Gotcha. I guess the other thing would be that in nature, terraces don't form perfectly level. So if we're going to emulate nature, we need to emulate nature, emulate something that doesn't actually exist. I've never found a perfectly level terrace that, like, was just put there by nature.
Well, you know, I'll bet you that there could be a few, kind of, but only terrace might not be quite the word.
Plateau, you know.
But what might happen is that, so for example, you could end up with something that's like a lake or a pond, and eventually it fills in with silt, and then you have a big flat spot.
Yep, that could happen.
Because it'll be a swamp for a while, and then eventually it's starts to firm up as it gets more and more silt in there certain times of year, and then during the drier part of the year, it'll be a big flat spot.
Gotcha.
You know, and so it's not exactly a terrace.
Yeah.
But
it makes sense. But, I mean, back to what Seth's doing, you're using the word edge, I'm using the word microclimate, but it is an edge system then, because the permaculture principle is all of the abundance happens on edges. Everything that's in surplus is on an edge somewhere. So by doing that, that makes perfect sense. So that takes my thing I thought was a problem and actually turns it into a solution.
Some plants like more water, some plants like less water, you know, and so then you've got all these different places that you're creating, and then so some plants will grow over there in the wetter spots, and some plants will grow over here in the drier spots, and yeah, edge. So now we've got more water in some places than we do in others. So, and that's one way to replace irrigation. So now your thirstier plants have a spot for them. All right, moving along. Reduce wind. So, of course, you know, when you got a lot of wind coming across your soil, it dries it out. And so, like, one of the things that Holzer does is that he's got all those hugelkultur beds, and he shapes them in such a way to be against the wind, so that way, at the bottom of the hugelkultur bed, they're rarely experiencing any wind at all. So, less wind.
Awesome.
Swales. So this is one that you've brought up several times. And so it's basically a big old ditch that's perfectly level. So most ditches are going to have, you know, a downhill path. They're going to carry water to someplace. A swale is the opposite. A swale is going to be carrying water nowhere. And the idea is that as excessive water comes down the hillside, hits a swale, it fills the swale. And then it also captures any soil that might be trying to escape your property, and it's going to concentrate the water in that spot. And so then usually it's going to puddle up and last for several weeks and make that area very, very moist. And when combined with the excess soil and silt that it's collected, as well as organic matter, you end up, as the swale is going to slowly fill up with soil and stop being a swale, but then it's got this big, thick patch of soil. Now you're going to have this strip on your land where things tend to grow a little bit lusher than in other places, because it's got more soil, more water, more everything, more goodness for plants.
And back to it, I've created another edge.
And you've created another edge. And, I mean, edge comes in a lot of flavors. So, but today, of course, we're talking about, you know, edges of water. You can make edge of temperature, like micro. So when you say microclimate, I usually kind of think of like how to make a spot that's a little bit warmer, and so that's a you know, so
or a little bit cooler, or a little bit shaded, or a little bit more sunny, or I mean, there's
There's edge on top of edge on top of edge. I use the analogy when I'm teaching it of when you watch guys fish a lake. You know, watch bass fishermen fish a lake. You don't see them out in the middle of the lake sitting there fishing for bass. They're all along the edges because that's where the abundance is. And even when you do see the guy in the middle of the lake, what you can't see is on his graph there's a big hill or a hump or some structure down there. Or even when they look like they're on open water, there's a great big cloud of bait fish, and they're fishing for the fish on the cloud edge of that. I mean, there's always an edge wherever there's life.
Right. An edge you don't hear about very often, which I think is a very important edge, is a pH edge. So when you have a conifer, the soil around the conifer tends to be very acidic. And so then, you know, as you get further away from the conifer, you experience a rainbow. A spectrum of different pH levels. And so then, that's why it's, even though I generally, look at a conifer as a kind of weed, the value that a conifer has in a permaculture system is that you have islands of conifers throughout your property, thereby providing a pH edge that it's difficult to get in any other way.
Absolutely. That makes perfect sense. So where do I grow my blueberries? Well, on that pH edge.
You're going to grow them near your conifers.
Correct.
Which is why here in Montana, huckleberries, which are very close kin to blueberries, and some blueberry experts claim that they're actually the same, you'll find your blueberries growing near conifers, or your huckleberries growing near conifers. Okay, next one, less transplanting, more seed starting. Did I already talk about this one a little bit?
A little bit.
So Sepp Holzer does not transplant anything. He has a greenhouse, but he uses it only for raising worms, for raising earthworms. He doesn't use it for any kind of transplanting, any kind of starting, anything like that. So the more you start it from seed, the more robust it's going to be. And the next item is tap-rooted species of plants and trees and whatnot, and you do not get the taproot if you start it from a transplant.
It's impossible. It'll stun.
Now Helen and I have talked about this many times, and she claims that she's been able to preserve the taproot with a special kind of transplant. There's a thing that you start plants in that's like 18 inches long, and then she claims that she has been able to preserve the taproot. But of course, the switch off is like, okay, Alan, were you actually able to like go in and look, dig down 20 feet, down like, 20 years later and see the taproot there and be able to have, your control right next door where I started this one from seed and be able to do a comparative analysis between the two. And of course she hasn't been able to do that. But a lot of anything that's with roots, really, there's a lot of speculation because it's so difficult to actually go and measure the root stuff later. But I'm going to stick to anytime you transplant, even if you use Helen's really awesome 18-inch transplant container, I think you're still going to lose your transplant. I think you're just still lose your taproot. I think that it's still going to have a transplant shock, and it's going to drop that taproot. And so starting from seed is a great way to reduce your need for irrigation. And then moving into taprooted species, having taprooted plants mixed into your polyculture is a great way to go and find that water that's down deep that was put there last winter that, here you are in August and you need water. It's going to go find that water, bring it up, and through polyculture share it with the other plants as well as through transpiration. Paddock shift grazing. I think we're on to number 12 or so. This is an amazing thing, started years ago, by Alan Savory's book. I think it was about maybe 35, 40 years ago he wrote this book. And where he put forth the concept of controlling your mob grazing, where you graze in an area for maybe a day, maybe a week, and then that area gets, like a month of rest. But, and then you bring your animals back and pulse it again. And that by doing this, that people have now experienced five times more growth of the vegetation in that area. Typically, it's grasses and forbs, and arguably possibly some other species. But for the most part, now there's an excellent magazine out there called the Stockman Grass Farmer Journal, and all the articles in that magazine assume that you start with that system. They just assume that everybody's doing that now. That's like the way to do it. Because, you know, if you think about it, if you're going to raise cattle, and if you do it grass-fed, I mean, you've pretty much eliminated all your feed costs in a way. And if you can get five times more feed for them by just how you manage the way that they, you know, go around and eat stuff, I mean, that's a, you know, ka-ching.
Absolutely.
Yeah. And now, from our perspective as permaculturalists, if you have five times more plant growth, I mean, that's five times more organic matter in the area, five times more shade, five times more all kinds of things.
Five times more sponginess, five times more ability to go down deep in the earth and pull water up. I mean, it five times more ability to hold back the water that does show up in the form of rain.
It's just a big plus in reducing irrigation. Not to mention the fact that, you know, you're going to have an animal go over to whatever the water source is, get a great big old drink, and then wander back over to the dry spot and take a leak. And so, does that not also help? And our topic is how to replace irrigation. I mean, that helps a little. And this is also, we got 16 different ways of helping a little bit at a time here and there and here and there. And now here's one. Once a month, an animal comes in and pisses on it.
Absolutely. And I mean, if they did it every day in the same spot, that's a problem. But in this type of a situation, that doesn't occur.
Right. I mean, maybe one spot out of 100 spots or something, you know.
Gotcha.
Yeah, so plus if you're moving the animals through, if you get a month of rest in between, then it's not going to be a problem. You know, you're eliminating the problem. And you know, granted, you're going to drop a big old cow pie somewhere. There's some species that aren't going to be able to handle the cow pie, but there are some species that are going to be able to handle the cow pie. Now you've also just created another edge.
Correct. Absolutely. Absolutely. And people wonder why they have, like they say, you can't do this and produce, you know, 8,000 acres of corn. Well, that's because it's not the way that, you know, I mean, I did a big talk in California about 2 years ago, and I was talking about basically how to construct a food forest, do it multiple layers and things like that. And a guy came up to me, and he had a peach and an apricot orchard and said, this won't work on my orchard. And I said, well, you've heard nothing I've said because obviously it won't work without a complete redesign of what you're doing. If you want 100 trees in perfectly straight lines so that an automatic picking thing can drive down there, and you don't want any diversity and you don't want a dandelion, I mean, yeah, you're right. It won't work this way, but that's the point. That's the entire point, you know? And he's like, well, I can't just tear out my, you know, 8,000 acres or whatever of, you know, I don't think it was that much. It was like 80 acres of trees. I said, why don't you start with 2 acres? Why don't you just take a piece of it and start trying these systems and experimenting with them? Anyway, I didn't want to stop you because we are over time again, as we always seem to do when you're here. But let's keep going because you got paddock shift grazing. The next thing I see on your list is, and folks, don't worry about getting all these written down. I'll put all these things in the show notes. The next one I see is DuPont. So that's a new one for me. I think I know what it is, but explain it to me.
Well, I just really quick, Juana, you said orchard. And so now I have to. I can't stop myself. I'm powerfully compelled to say, I believe there's no such thing as a permaculture orchard. You know, an orchard is another kind of monocrop. And so
I completely agree.
If you put it in an orchard, doom. So don't do food forest. So for example, if you want an apple orchard, but you want it to be permaculture-esque, then you're going to do a bunch of different trees, and maybe one tree out of 10 will be an apple tree.
But you end up with a huge apple yield that way.
Your apple yield will probably be about one-third of if it was nothing but apple trees. On the other hand, You are getting a ton of other crops too. You're getting
absolutely.
You're going to end up with more food per acre.
Well, that's the thing. I always when I have these conversations with people that are doing things in what we'll call a conventional manner is, I can't give you more apples. I can give you more total yield. And you're not dependent on a single or two crops, so that if one year we happen to have something that does come in and smite the apples for a year, you haven't lost the farm, quite literally. You've got other, you know, maybe you've got pecan, maybe you've got, maybe you've got some type of a wildlife forage, maybe, and you've got a wildlife yield, or you've got a cattle yield, or you know, it doesn't, you're right, it doesn't work if we do it the exact same way you've always been doing it, and just stop doing all the things that you do to make it work. But again, that's the point.
So I think, you know, usually what you'll do is if you go from an orchard to a food forest, you're going to increase your total crop yield for that per acre by probably a factor of 10. And at the same time, you're probably going to cut your workload by a factor of 10. And so, you know, to me, the math is pretty simple. But all right, moving on. DuPonts. DuPonts come in two different flavors. There's one where you just kind of make a little depression in the ground, where a pond could be, but you don't have any water going in and any water going out, and it's dependent on rain and whatever else might just happen to find its way to that pond. The advantage is that I wouldn't put fish in there or anything like that, and nor would I really be really excited about the idea of having animals drink from that water. But one of the things you'll be raising the general humidity in the area. And then of course, you know, you've also added edge. You've added a kind of edge. And you might want to put a couple of things in there to eat any kind of mosquitoes. a couple goldfish wouldn't be such a bad idea.
Sure. Absolutely. But
there's another kind of DuPont that I think is really interesting, and that is where, it's kind of like from the book or even the movie Dune, and the idea is that you have inside of a mountain of sorts, or inside of you've carved out a spot, and then as air passes through there, that warm air is carrying a little bit of moisture, and then inside the hillside it's cold, and you'll get condensation, and then the condensation will fill a pond in there. Or if it overflows, it could actually, you know, you will have created a really lame spring of sorts. Water will dribble out of that by taking moisture out of the air. So that's another kind of DuPont.
Very, very cool.
And along those lines brings us to the next item on the list, and that is stacked rocks.
I'm going to stop you there because I know there's a bunch of people going right now. Now, especially if they're from Texas, right? How am I going to go out there and get a whole bunch of rocks and stack them up in a pile in the middle of this field and it's going to make water? This boy's plumb lost his mind. So explain, because I know how it works, but I know that that's going to, right now, there's someone out there thinking, yeah, that's right. You don't make water out of a rock. Explain how this works.
Okay, I think, you know, the best place to put a stack of rocks is at the drip line of a tree. So on the edge of the, but basically, like, let's say you get this stack of rocks and you stack them 6 feet tall. And let's say they're pretty big rocks, like as big as you can carry. Then, the rocks on the outside are boring, but it's the rocks on the inside that are interesting. And what happens is that your warm, air that's gonna have some moisture in it is going to hit those rocks on the inside, which are going to be much colder, much cooler, and then you're going to get condensation on those inside rocks. And then the condensation is going to drip off into the soil. And so usually a tree can easily take advantage of that extra moisture that's coming right there. And this is something you can put in lots of different places throughout your property. Seth Holzer loves rocks in his stuff. And it's like, it's funny because like right where I am in Montana, if I look out my window, I'm looking out on this wheat field where the guy does everything conventional. He just went and disced his land, and which exposed a whole bunch of rocks. So then he spent days going out there picking up all these rocks. And I was watching him driving around with his tractor and this big, in the bucket there. He's like picking up the rocks and everything. And he makes big piles. And where the piles are, I'm thinking, now that's where you're going to have your best growth of all kinds of stuff. But, of course, that's where he's growing his weed crop, which I'm sure he's going to spray at some point. But I think that wherever he's got these rock piles, he should plant trees around them. And then the trees, he'll have this magnificent tree crop.
Absolutely.
But Sepp Holzer uses rocks for all kinds of stuff. Rocks are great temperature buffers. Rocks do all kinds of, well, anyway, all right, we got to finish the list.
Yeah.
But stacked rocks, it's going to bring you water where you currently don't have much. Edges. We've already talked about edges. That's the next thing on the list. And finally, the last thing on the list is really obvious. Shade. Some plants do better with less sunlight. So I've got another presentation that I've got about, I think it's the presentation I have about making the big bucks. It's got a quote from David Bloom, because we've got, of course, a whole bunch of threads about how to get by with less water in permaculture. And David Bloom has this awesome essay that he wrote about having 2 acres a little ways outside of San Francisco and how he fed over 300 people year-round on this 200 acres. And then he goes into a lot of detail talking about how much sunlight different plants need. Some plants actually will produce more if they have less sunlight. And so that would mean that they get a couple of hours in the morning and a couple of hours in the afternoon, and then they produce more than if they had all-day sun. And so, like, take advantage of that, as well as the fact that when you simply have shade, then you don't give up as much water to the sun. Your soil doesn't bake as much, and your plants don't bake as much, and everything's able to hold on to more moisture. The end.
Well, it makes perfect sense to me, and I think a lot of people are probably blown away right now, and their mind's going 1,000 miles an hour, and they're also thinking, well, I can't do all of this. And I mean, I'll tell you what, if you're sitting in the middle of suburbia, you're not going to probably have a lot of paddock, sectored off grazing livestock. But a lot of the stuff you've heard, you can integrate into what you're doing. And I think that it's about kind of picking a few things and getting a start and then starting to look at, well, where could I put a stack of rocks? Where could I create my version of a dew pond? And I think a lot of folks, even on small pieces of land, could do 80% or more of this if they wouldn't. Like you said right from the beginning, though, if you do hookah culture, you've skinned the cat a long way just out of the gate just with that. So amazing presentation as always, Paul.
So this is a big part to talk about hookah culture and the fact that there's the two important videos on hookah culture out there on YouTube right now. One is where we're showing we're making a hookah culture bad. And then the other one, which is probably the most important for anybody who thinks that it's a bunch of hooey, is to go and look at it. I got Mark Vandermeer standing next to a place where he laid down a wood 3 feet deep, only 3 feet deep, threw some soil on it, and planted some trees in there, including some riparian species trees. So this is water-loving trees, trees that cannot survive without a lot of water. And then I think I filmed them in July, and he hasn't watered it at all that year, and it is huge and lush. And now this is in Missoula,
yep,
which is mountain desert. So we only get 13 yep inches of rain a year, and here he's standing next to this spot that is just crazy lush.
Yep.
Crazy lush in July, and as I look around in that area, everything else looks, you know, like a desert.
It can't work either, because not only is it just hookah culture doing it, he buried spruce. And everybody knows you can't grow nothing around a spruce tree.
Right.
But yet he did it anyway, because it works.
It does. It works. I mean, once it starts to decompose, you know, the spruce loses its allelopathic elements. And granted, the spruce is going to continue to make the soil fairly acidic for a while, but the video, I believe, is like 7 years later. And so by then, the spruce is probably, you know, decomposed beyond recognition.
Sure. It's all just a spongy material. So, man, Paul, this was an awesome show, as always. We'll definitely want to have you back on for more subjects. I do want to make sure everybody knows how to find out more about you and stuff like that. So you've got two big websites out there. One is permies.com. That's your forum. I talk about you all the time and send people your way. Let's make sure we do that today. Richsoil.com. That's where your articles are. And you've got a podcast out now and kind of put together with a blog, and I'm going to see what I can do to help you get that thing tuned up a little bit. But you are on iTunes with your new podcast, And you've got your YouTube channel. So to make everybody's life easy, including yours, I will put links to all of those things in today's show notes.
Awesome.
All right. Well, hey, man, you got anything else for me? I mean, we're at an hour and, I don't know, like an hour and 2 hours or something. An hour and 27 minutes, which is long for the show. But, hey, man, that's why we're not on the radio, so I can do stuff like this. But you got anything else you want to add before we wrap up today?
I want to say, as of this morning, I just found out that my lawn care article is now number 8 on Google for lawn care, and I think a big part of that has to do with the last time that I was on your show, and I asked people to make that link, and then you gave them the template for that in the show notes, and so I think a bunch of people must have done it. And,
Very cool.
So I moved from about number 14 or so up to number 8, and so I want to say thank you to your listeners who did that. It's that kind of activity that gives me the gumption to make more articles and more videos.
Very, very cool. Well, again, I appreciate you coming out today, and I'll throw up a thing about how to do that again. If you got a blog or something and you haven't done this yet, I mean, Paul just gave us a massive amount of information. Maybe consider throwing him a link to his lawn care article just in one of your posts or something like that. It'll do a lot to help him out. I also left out, you've got your Facebook page, so I'll make sure we have links to that. Connect with Paul on Facebook. All of these things help content producers reach more people. And the reality is, as Paul said several times today, a lot of the stuff isn't just what we know, it's what we don't know yet. And the only way we're going to find out all these additional things we can learn and what we don't know is to get more people than just a few of us doing it. So the more people we get active, and people are going to bifurcate, they're going to go off their own way, and Paul's going to say, don't do this, and somebody's going to do it, and they might not have the exact results they're looking for, but they might find something new. And, you know, it's the old saying, there's more than one way to skin a cat. And I think it's time we get out of this, you know, monoculture. To me, that's the problem. We've come up with an answer to an incalculable problem. And, Paul, thanks today for kind of opening hearts and minds to a bunch of ways to skin that cat.
Thanks for having me, Jack.
All right, folks, and with that, this has been Jack Spirko today along with Paul Wheaton, helping you figure out how to live that better life if times get tough, or even if they don't. Well, thanks for tuning in to this episode of the Survival Podcast Friday Flashbacks. If you enjoyed today's show, please consider becoming an MSB member. Just go to thesurvivalpodcast.com and click on members to learn more. You can also support our show by going to TSPAZ, that's T-S-P-A-Z, TSPAZ.com, anytime you shop online. And while you'll support us, no matter what you buy, you will find over 500 reviews of items I have personally tested and vouched for. And to stay in touch with us and never miss anything, follow our channel or our group on Telegram. You can find links to that and all our social media options. Just go to thesurvivalpodcast.com and check the show notes for any episode.